Blog Talk Radio.
About these different things, so they took it to
They took it to the hill. But I don't know. I just thought it was...
kind of funny, huh?
Yeah, I just thought it was funny. There was a little more to this, but ashamed to be... People were kind of ridiculous, but... Hey, you know.
I wish that showed some outrage at some other stuff.
Yeah, I mean, over. You
stuff
know,
that's really
like
important.
That. You know, it's like too bad. You know, I really feel terrible about that, right? But, you know, you get. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe there's no reason to go there. This one here was kind of bothering me because he was at the. The New York Fed knew a false. Barclay reports on interest rates, and you know this thing is so rigged. It's so incredibly rigged that the Federal Reserve knew that Barclays was screwing around with the interest rates, refused to do anything about it. All right, they control. They said, "Oh, we don't have any control over these guys." Yeah, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York learned on April 2008 that the financial crisis was brewing, and at least one bank was reporting false interest rates.
Huh.
At the time, Barclays' employee told the New York Fed official that we know that we're not posting an honest rate, according to the documents released by the regulator on Friday. The employee indicated that other big banks made similar bogus reports, saying that the British institution wanted to fit in with the rest of the crowd. Although the New York Fed confirmed with Britain and American regulators about the problem, recommended reforms, it failed to stop the illegal activity, which persisted through 2009. So it's like they knew it. They did nothing.
Uh-huh.
Because all their banks were fixing rates too. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like
the sham that they just had a snippet on TV. They showed the chairman of the Federal Reserve, and then they had a couple of senators asking him questions.
That's the game.
It was just such a joke.
It's a joke, you know. Oh, well, we didn't know anything, but we don't have any control over now.
Yeah.
But you can give that bank $1 trillion of taxpayer money, though, can't you?
Yeah.
Barclays and HBC and Royal Bank of Scotland and everybody else gets our money.
Except the taxpayer.
But we have no control over it.
Yeah.
Right. Sure.
Yeah. And the I love the sham that the two... senators put on. Either they're complete idiots or they really know how to feign caring. Because the whole system is fixed, and if they don't know that it is, then there's something really wrong with them.
Exactly. You know the errors. Lila brought this to my attention.
I thought this was
very, very good.
Bounty hunters unleashed on crooked bankers. Iceland has potentially set a new trend in the finance community. According to Business Insider, their government has hired an ex-cop, a white-collar crime bounty hunter, who wants to make sure that the bankster criminals pay the price for their elaborate crimes. Iceland's government appointed Ólafur Dan Hauksson to locate such individuals that had a helping hand in the collapse of the banking sector in a time of extreme credit crunching. Hauksson is responsible for investigating any and all suspicious cases involving fraud before 2009. The good news from him is that he's not working alone. He's got 100 top-notch researchers rigorously working around the clock to help make this a smoother and quicker process. Mr. Hauksson expands on this notion, saying, on the other hand, we bring the lawsuits against the suspects to court ourselves. The technique is brand new stuff which allows the investigators to follow the case in the judicial system to know the cases like the back of their hand. This is undeniably advantageous in order to compete with the well-prepared defense attorneys. And don't think that fleeing the country warrants your safekeeping. Le Monde reported Charlotte Shabazz explains, searches continue and the team pursues its investigation abroad in the foreign subsidiaries of the Icelandic bank and includes questioning foreigners. We enjoy full international cooperation. Hauksson has all of his ducks in a row when it comes to this mission. He's got some impressive convictions under his belt. meriting quite a bit of respect for the success he's experienced in this new job. He's even tracked down the former chief of staff of the country's finance minister and arrested him for insider trading. While many criminals that have already been caught still wait their sentencing, Hoxton is actively on the prowl to find more felons. With plenty of places to run but nowhere to hide, some big banks are surely weak in the knees and stressed to the core. Who's to say other countries are not already doing the very same thing in order to crack down on the greed and fraudulence that led the latest overwhelming economic collapse?
Well, we know that other countries aren't doing a damn thing. Because those guys are still walking around.
Mm-hmm. You got that right.
They're still walking around. And without a care in the world. This one killed me.
Oh, I read that.
Yeah, didn't that kill you?
Mm-hmm.
To read this.
Neocons attack food stamps.
And corporations are getting that are administering are getting 95% of the money. Neocons attack food stamps. As predicted on from the Trenches World Report, the attack on the poor and impoverished have been renewed in the wake of the affirmation of the Supreme Court of the unconstitutional Obamacare. A $16 billion cut in food stamps, which was made a part of the Farm Bill, was blocked by the Soviet socialist arm of the socialist insurgency. Not because they give one little damn of poor people starved to death, but rather because the contractors who own them are the ones stealing 95 cents out of every food stamp dollar through the administration of the program. The neocon national socialists are going to continue to go after food stamps with a viciousness, and I will tell you why. Americans are not a people to be held down. Many former middle class who have and are being thrust into poverty are at present devising and implementing 10,000 strategies designed to claw their way back up. You see, you cannot just destroy America by destroying small businesses. We Americans built this country out of nothing and are stepping up to the score to do so again. This is why Obamacare was affirmed to put another $2,600 of taxes between the impoverished American entrepreneur and the bottom tier of the middle class. This is why they want reductions in food stamps, welfare, Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare. I'm not sure I understand who's talking here.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of...
I don't understand this either. You see, these socialist programs were sold to us back when we were still in the middle class as a safety net to help us pull ourselves back up if we were knocked down. But the way the programs have been constructed, they're actually designed to keep us down and gradually starve us into submission to slavery while making sure the majority of the tax dollars are being taken from what's left of our middle class for these programs, are being funneled directly into the coffers of the very elitists that have intentionally moved our industry out of this country, destroyed our economy while procuring record profits for themselves every inch of the way. We, the American people of the American race, have to let these despicable dirtbags know that our emphasis will not be in taking food out of our neighbors' mouths who have been impoverished through the deliberate actions of the international elite. We must let them know that we want the international economic terrorists who have stolen $38 trillion from we the people, arrested, tried, and punished, and we want our stolen wealth back, which after we will use that wealth to starve the insurgents out of our government. They know we do not need them. All we have to do is realize this is our wealth manufactured from the sweat of our brows that is being used to attack us. We know who our enemies are and that they are not only attempting to hold us down, but also destroy what is left of our middle class and bring them into slavery also.
So, you know, this guy's from the trenches.
His thought process could be a little better organized.
I think so. I was going through this and I thought, well, it made sense, but I should always read to the end of an article.
Yeah.
It's kind of a typical, I don't know what kind of bonehead wrote this, but What do you think?
Of that article?
Yeah. It doesn't it's like he doesn't know what he's talking about. You know?
A lot of words.
Yeah, but it's like he's a Tea Party guy. He doesn't know what he's talking about. First he slams the neocons, who are socialists, actually. But then he slams the socialists, who are Democrats or whatever. He doesn't make any sense.
I do agree with slamming both sides, but in his thought process,
So, excuse us, folks, for bringing that one up.
That's a great picture.
What's up? Oh, you want to play this?
Yeah, let's play this.
Hillary Clinton, you are not welcomed in Egypt. Get out. At MoxNews.com. Hillary and with the Minister of Egypt.
Overseas now, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton today became the first high-profile Western diplomat to call on Egypt's new president. Clinton assured Mohamed Morsi that Washington backs his country's transition to full democracy, despite long-held suspicions about the Islamist party he represents. Our Middle East correspondent Sasha Petrzik has more from Jerusalem. Sasha?
Well, Kim, Egypt presents a real challenge for the United States right now. Washington has been pushing for democracy, but the results of that process presented American diplomacy with a real problem. Hillary Clinton arrived today to meet the man that Egyptians have elected as their president in the first three elections in a very long time. Now, he comes from the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamist movement that the United States once vowed it would never even talk to. Now it has to, if it wants to maintain good relations with the largest country in the Middle East. After her meeting with Morsi, Clinton said that Egypt needs to finish the transition toward democracy.
Democracy is hard. We have been at this for more than 236 years, and it requires dialogue and compromise and real politics.
But even on the streets, the United States has big problems here. Among most Egyptians, it's not very popular, especially among those who came out to protest Clinton's visit today. All this despite the fact that the U.S. contributes more than $1.5 billion in aid to Egypt every year, mostly to the military.
Go out of Egypt! Out of Egypt!
Others are concerned that the U.S. is now cozying up to an Islamist movement that could end up limiting basic rights, especially for women. But in reality, the Americans have very little choice. Aside from everything else, Egypt is the linchpin in a delicate peace agreement with Israel that was brokered by the U.S. three decades ago. If Egypt were to pull out, the results could be very unpredictable, perhaps pushing the whole region into turmoil. And that is something that Washington is very eager to avoid. Kim?
All right. Thanks so much, Sasha.
Huh.
Yeah, so anyway, that's they don't want us there. They don't want anything
you don't think
to do
so?
With us. And, you know, it's becoming crazy. Here's something that is a little bothersome to read. Insurance companies, government steals life insurance benefits from post-traumatic stress.
Veterans.
Post-traumatic stress disease veterans who commit suicide.
Mm-hmm.
I remember something about this years ago where we read on the air. Remember how they were betting?
Oh, terrible!
How insurance companies were taken out.
This is despicable. There is diabolical, and there are both. This appears to be a story about the latter. Families of four veterans diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder following the tours of duty in combat zones who committed suicide after returning home are charging Prudential Insurance and the Department of Veterans Affairs with refusing to pay life insurance benefits they are due. Matthew Ecker, the lead plaintiff in the case, which was recently filed in the U.S. District Court in Newark, New Jersey, said that his son Michael, who served in Iraq in 2005 to 2006, received at least 11 medals, ribbons, and badges for his service. The plaintiff goes on to say the following, that following his son's return, the parents observed a dramatic change in his personality. He was in constant physical pain, suffered memory loss, and was anxious all of the time. Michael never left the war behind, and after medical treatment efforts failed him on August 28, 2009, he walked to the garden, saluted his father in military fashion, placed a gun to his head, and pulled the trigger. The complaint says the elder Ecker was the sole beneficiary of his son's service members group life insurance policy, which amounted to $400,000. Matthew has testified under oath that while alive, Michael never received from Prudential any notice that he could convert his policy to the Veterans Group life insurance policy, the complainant says. The families claim Prudential denied them benefits they were due because their veteran children did not switch their policies to the veterans policy within 120 days of leaving the military. They also say that Prudential did not inform their veteran children about switching their coverage in a timely manner. In the filing, attorneys for his family cited two previous instances in which where the VA ordered Prudential to pay late claims to the beneficiaries of deceased victims. In one case, Prudential paid the benefit in that case, even though the veteran failed to timely convert his policy. Number two, more than 2 years had elapsed between the deactivation and death. And three, the veteran had been able to work at a refinery for a period of 15 months between deactivation and death, says the complainant.
In the other case of information and belief, Prudential was ordered by SVA, the Secretary of Veteran Affairs of VA, the Department of Veteran Affairs, to pay the VGLI benefit to the beneficiary of a veteran who committed suicide on the basis that Prudential had failed to notify the veteran upon deactivation from the service or separation from the ready serve that he could convert his SGLI policy to VGLI, the complaint says. And the plaintiffs charged that Prudential intentionally denied the benefits of the life insurance of their insured under the SGLI and VGLI programs with no rational basis for doing so, whereas others identically situated to plaintiffs were paid benefits under the life insurance policies. History of shortchanging vets and beneficiaries. It's not the first time Prudential has earned the ire of the beneficiaries of deceased veterans. In 2010, the parents of six deceased soldiers sued the insurance company in a class action for allegedly paying paltry interest on military life benefits while keeping higher interest earnings for itself. The suit accused Prudential of profiting from the dead soldiers' policies with bookkeeping maneuvers and misrepresenting the way the beneficiaries could collect lump sum payouts. The company said it did everything within the letter and spirit of its obligation, but the families alleged that as beneficiaries, they received 0.5 to 1.5% interest on money marked in alliance accounts over the previous several years. But the plaintiffs say the checks are equivalent to an IOU and that the money doesn't actually sit in those accounts as of the time of the soldier's death. Instead, the plaintiffs said that their complaints, Prudential parks the funds in a $200 billion general account that earns 5 to 6% interest, moves it into an alliance account only when requested to do so by the beneficiary, and pays out the lower rate and keeps the difference. Freaking crooks, man. A bunch of crooks. They're just crooks. And this is Prudential. So, you know, you want to boycott Prudential. Cancel your Prudential policy. Get something else. You know? Crooks.
Pretty bad.
Yeah, they're damn crooks. It's just unbelievable. You know? So, anyway.
Take advantage of the helpless.
Some
poor guy who has post-traumatic stress disorder.
It's just, you know, God. This one was interesting because over the years we've talked about this on our show, and back in 2003 when we were doing our program, Bush stole. Somebody stole everything out of the Iraq. Remember museums?
Mm-hmm.
You remember that?
I think lots of artifacts have been stolen.
Well, they were. I mean, the reason they were, I mean, they backed up a truck right there, and the first thing they
just
took...
Just loaded it right
the
up.
The first thing they took was all of the Sumerian records and all
tablets.
Of the... All the tablets, right. They were all gone. But, okay, Iraq wants all U.S. stolen archaeological treasures back. That's what they do, but let's just see what they're saying here. Iraq says it wants all of the archaeological treasures stolen by U.S. forces in 2003, but Washington has offered to return only half. Iraq rejected the offer made by the United States to bring back half of the Iraq Jewish archive, previously transferred from Baghdad to the United States during the U.S.-led invasion of the country. Insisting that Baghdad had to restore the whole archive, Iraqi newspaper Al-Sabah reported on Sunday. The archive includes century-old Torah scrolls and plenty of other documents in Hebrew, Arabic, and English. And Iraqi tourism and archaeological minister Mullah Shamizu reiterated that it, the Iraq Jewish Archive, is part of the Iraqi heritage. That the ministry media office chief, I'll bet that damn archive is sitting in Israel right now. And on June 11th, Samazin said that the U.S. had transferred the archives to Israel, in addition to about 1,000 Iraqi antiquities. And the information angered archaeologists and officials who accused Washington of looting Iraq's cultural heritage and dissuaded Iraqi authorities from continuing cultural cooperation with the U.S. The ministry recently suspended cooperation with the American universities and their excavation missions in the country, the Iraq minister said. So, isn't that interesting that all of that went to Israel? They stole it from Iraq, and they're only getting back half. All right. So where's the other half?
Yeah.
Where are we going to give back half? Don't make much sense to me. By the way, in case you want to know, okay, people in Israel aren't too thrilled about the way Israel is going.
There are a lot of dissenters there. You don't hear too much from them in our media.
No.
You wouldn't think there are any dissenters in Israel, but it's a very oppressive regime.
Yes.
Not a democracy. Moshe Silman poured gasoline on his body on Saturday night in Tel Aviv and set himself on fire to protest the Israeli regime's economic policies. He's fighting for his life at the hospital, having suffered extensive burns. The demonstrators have vowed to continue their protests until they achieve their goal. On Saturday, more than 10,000 people took to the streets in several locations across the occupied territories to mark the first anniversary of the social justice protests that swept the territories last year. They called for the resignation of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Hundreds of thousands of people marched and set up protest camps across the occupied territories during last summer's protests.
There you go. So, not everybody in Israel likes Israel.
Likes Israeli policy.
Yeah. Oh, and of course the Egyptians built that Clinton's watergate with the heroes and bottles.
She deserves that.
Yeah. Protesters in the city of Alexandria in northeastern Egypt throwing bottles and tomatoes at the motorcade for visiting U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. On Sunday, a large number of demonstrators gathered outside the U.S. consulate in the city to denounce Washington's interference in their country's internal affairs, Reuters reported. We are, first of all, opposed to the American visit to Egypt. Why? Because they, Americans, are trying to put pressure on the new presidential institution. And we fundamentally cannot accept any interference in Egyptian affairs, the protesters said.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're absolutely right, but it doesn't get them anywhere. All right. UN set up to ban, this is quite surprising, but Alice gets a little off the wall on that. So, you on it?
Yeah.
Okay, let's go over this one.
I think we have an audio piece that we could play.
I was hoping to, but there's something on the next page that I'll get to. But
Then we could have a little music break.
Yeah.
After this article.
You want to do this one first?
Yeah, we'll do this one first. We'll have an audio music break. And while we're breaking, we can look for that audio piece. Maybe we'll be able to find
it. We will find it. There's two, actually.
Yeah. This is The Watchers, How to Open the Third Eye, Solar Storms and the Pleiadians Riding the Power Wave. According to study published in The New Scientist back in 1998, there is a direct connection between the sun's solar storms and human biological effects. The conduit which facilitates the charged particles from the sun to human disturbance is the very same conduit which steers Earth's weather, the magnetic field. Animals and humans have a magnetic field which surrounds them in the very same way the magnetic field surrounds the Earth as a protector. From 1948 to 1997, the Institute of North Industrial Ecology Problems in Russia found that geomagnetic activity showed three seasonal peaks each of these years, March to May, in July and October. Every peak matched an increased incidence of anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder, and suicide in the city of Kravacek. Electromagnetic activity from the sun affects our electronic devices and human electromagnetic field. We are physically, mentally, and emotionally altered by electromagnetic charges from the sun. Our body can feel sleepy, but also become highly energized. Psychological effects of coronal mass injections are typically short-lived and include headaches, palpitations, mood swings, and feeling generally unwell. Chaotic or confused thinking, erratic behaviors also increase. Solar storms can drive our emotions and maximize it, both good and the bad side. The point here is to be aware of it. Pineal gland in our brain is also affected by the electromagnetic activity, which causes the gland to produce excess melatonin, a hormone which causes sleepiness, but it is also known that some people have auspicious side effects. Usually those that have it are aware of the effects.
Riding the power wave. Pineal gland stimulation. Our pineal glands have excess melatonin production from solar storms, electromagnetic activity. Many biological effects of melatonin are produced through activation of melatonin receptors, but while others are due to its role as a pervasive and powerful antioxidant with a particular role in the protection of nuclear and mitochondrial DNA. Pineal gland is also referred as the third eye, and the third eye is also known as the inner eye. The third eye is a mystical and esoteric concept referring to part of the ajna, or brow chakra, in certain Dharmic spiritual traditions, in particular Hinduism. This concept was later adopted by Christian mystics and spiritualists, as well as people from other religious faiths. It is also spoken of as the gate that leads in within to inner realms and spaces of higher consciousness. Among Christian mystics, the term is used in a broad sense to indicate a non-dualistic perspective. In New Age spirituality, the third eye may symbolize a state of enlightenment, or the evocation of mental images having deeply personal spiritual or psychological significance. The third eye is also associated with visions, clairvoyance, which includes the ability to observe chakras and auras, and recognition and out-of-body experiences. People who have allegedly developed the ability, the capacity to utilize their third eyes are sometimes known as seers. And for the reason most of you know, humans tend to have the pineal gland heavily calcified or sleeping. That's interesting. Fluoride, found in tap water, toothpaste, and processed foods, is just one of the things that causes the calcification of pineal gland. All right? Fluoride is magnetically attracted to the pineal gland, where it forms calcium phosphate crystals more than anywhere else in the body. How to decalcify pineal gland? One excellent link is here.
Mm-hmm.
Third eye should be active,
vibrant, and strong.
Yeah.
The process of decalcification sometimes includes headaches and sleepiness. the same as they say for solar storms like the one in effect now. Enjoy the weekend. And I don't know exactly where that link is. I didn't see it. Is there a link?
Yeah, it's right, hang on a second. You saw it, it said here.
I think that's important. We'll just...
How do you undo it?
We do. Is the site, how to decalcify your pineal gland. Tells you. The pineal gland can be the most important part of your entire nervous system. It is essentially a spiritual antenna. Your physical equivalent of a third eye. It is essential for reaching higher levels of consciousness. Most people know about this gland and the various legends and symbolism surrounding it from David Wilcock's classic video 2012, Enigma. Number one most viewed video on Google,
2008. Well, let's see. It's only 9 minutes long. I don't know if you
want to. Well, let's see what it is.
You want to play it?
Yeah, see, it might be of interest to people. It certainly is to me.
This is part of it.
Fabric of this universe is consciousness. which is what all the old mystics and all the old religious traditions have been saying for thousands of years. Now, what I offer is a much more elaborate and intricate spin on the notion of a consciousness field than you've probably ever seen anywhere else. Of course, it goes without saying that for those of you who haven't seen this, when they haven't seen it before, there's a gasp in the audience, but you all are well initiated. Edgar Cayce and myself, there's obviously a facial similarity there. This is my brother and Casey's first guy, Dr. Ketchum, who got him out there in the world. My father, after a Metallica concert, that's why he's sneering. And the squire, Edgar Cayce's father, my father, Elica, and this is Edgar's wife.
I'm going to pass on this thing because I saw this and it was crap of crap.
I thought there was going to be more on
This is where he starts to go a little berserk. He starts to classify himself. I apologize, folks, for bringing this one up. This is not good, and I don't think I'd advise anything with Wilcox in it. He thinks he's the reincarnation of Edgar Cayce.
In the meantime, let's go to a little music break.
Yeah. So, and that ain't going to happen to me. He says, because you say, oh, don't we look alike, Edgar Cayce and I? You know? And all these historical figures that he thinks that he's the reincarnation of Cayce or something. All right. So, anyway, we'll be back in a few minutes. I'll just play a little tune and come on, come right on back. Here we go. U.S. empire of bases grows. This was quite frightening, actually. We don't realize how many bases we have in the United States and in the world.
No, we don't.
Right now.
We never talk much about it.
You don't hear about it. You hear, oh, we got around 1,000 bases or something. But, you know, it's like the amount we spend over half of our national budget on military and supplying these things all around the world. And this article talks about it. So it says, U.S. empire bases grows. Excuse me. By David Vine and Tom Engler.
I can't really see.
Yeah, it was January 15th, 2004, when Tom Dispatch had only been in existence for a year, when Chalmers Johnson, author of the prophetic book Blowback, published in 2000 and a bestseller after the 9/11 attacks, did a piece of the for this site titled America's Empire of Bases.
Mm.
He wrote then, due to government secrecy, our citizens are often ignorant of the fact that our garrisons encircle the planet. This vast network of American bases on every continent except Antarctica actually constitutes a new form of empire. An empire of bases with its own geography, not likely to be taught in any high school geography class.
Got that right.
Without grasping the dimensions of this global girdling base world, one can begin to understand the size and nature of our imperial aspirations, or the degree to which a new kind of militarism is undermining our constitutional order.
It was a benchmark essay for Tom Dispatch, and the theme, the unprecedented way Washington was garrisoning the planet, that Johnson would return to repeatedly and that others of us would take up. This mattered because, despite the crucial role that Washington's empire of bases played in the American way of war and its dreams of global dominance, bases were then and remain today a phenomenon largely ignored in the mainstream media. In 2004, the Pentagon was, for instance, already building the first of its 505 bases, the biggest amongst them meant to be enduring in Iraq, American ziggurats, I called them at that time. Some of these were large enough to qualify as full-scale American towns with PXs, fire departments, bus routes, the usual range of fast food joints, internet cafes, and the like. And yet it was the rare American reporter who saw a story of any sort in them, even when visiting one of them. The same was true in Afghanistan, where the U.S. was building and is still upgrading 400 or more bases. No one even bothered to try to count them up until Nick Turse did so in February 2010 for this site. Ann Jones took Tom Dispatch readers onto one of them in August of that same year. In his books and at Tom Dispatch, Johnson put significant effort into trying to come up with a number for the bases the Pentagon garrisoned outside the United States. In January 2011, Turse returned to the task and found the number to be well over 1,100. Again, it's not a figure you normally see reported in the mainstream. In March 2010, John Pfeiffer reminded TD readers of just how far the Pentagon would go to hang on to a single major base among so many on the Japanese island of Okinawa.
One of the last essays Chalmers Johnson published at his site before his death in 2010 was entitled Dismantling the Empire, and it was concerned with just how the U.S. could downsize its global mission and its empire of bases. David Vine, anthropologist and author of Island of Shame, his secret history of the U.S. military base on Diego Garcia, has been touring American bases for the last 3 years. A major survey of the changing shape of our base world, he suggests that unfortunately it isn't shrinking at all, and that dismantling isn't yet on the American horizon. This means that until the mainstream finally stumbles upon the import of this story, Tom Dispatch has little choice but to stay on the base's beat for the foreseeable future. So, let's see. First thing I saw last month, the lily pad strategy.
Oh, they name everything, don't they?
Yeah. says, the first thing I saw last month when I walked into the belly of the dark gray C-17 Air Force cargo plane was a void, something missing, a missing left arm, to be exact, severed by the shoulder, temporarily patched and held together. Thick pale flesh flecked and
with red, bright red
at the edges. It looked like meat sliced open. The face and what remained of the rest of the man were obscured by blankets, an American flag cloak, jumble of tubes and tapes, wires, and so on and so forth.
The man and two other critically wounded soldiers, one with two stumps where legs had been, the other missing a leg below the thigh, were intubated, unconscious, and lying on stretchers hooked to the wall of the plane that had just landed at Ramstein Air Base in Germany. A tattoo on the soldier's remaining arm read, "Death before dishonor." I asked a member of the Air Force medical team about the casualties they see like these. Many, as with this flight, were coming from Afghanistan, he told me. A lot from the Horn of Africa, he added. You really don't hear about that in the media. Where in Africa, I asked. He said he didn't know exactly, but generally from the Horn, often with critical injuries. A lot out of Djibouti, he added, referring to Camp Lemonnier, the main U.S. base in Africa, but from elsewhere in the region, too. Since the Black Hawk down deaths in Somalia about 20 years ago, we've heard little, if anything, about American casualties in Africa, other than a strange report last week about three Special Operations Commandos killed, along with three women identified by the U.S. military sources as Moroccan prostitutes, in a mysterious car accident in Mali. The growing number of patients arriving at Ramstein from Africa pulls back a curtain on a significant transformation in the 21st century U.S. military strategy. These casualties are likely to be the vanguard of a growing number of wounded troops coming from places far removed from Afghanistan or Iraq. They reflect the increased use of relatively small bases like Camp Lemonnier, which military planners see as a model for the future U.S. base scattered, as one academic explains, across regions in which the United States has previously not maintained a military presence. Disappearing are the days when,
when Ramstein was the signature U.S. base.
An American town-sized behemoth filled with thousands or tens of thousands of American PXs, Pizza Huts, and other amenities of home. But don't for a second think that the Pentagon is packing up, downsizing its global mission, and heading home. In fact, based on developments in recent years, the opposite may be true. While the collection of Cold War-era giant bases around the world is shrinking, the global infrastructure of bases overseas has exploded in size and scope. Unknown to most Americans, Washington's garrisoning of the planet is on the rise thanks to a newer generation of military bases called lily pads.
These are small, secretive, inaccessible facilities with limited numbers of troops, Spartan amenities, and pre-positioned weaponry and supplies. And around the world, from Djibouti to the jungles of Honduras, deserts of
Mauritania to Australia's tiny Cocos Islands, the Pentagon has been pursuing as many lily pads as it can in as many countries as it can, as fast as it can. Although statistics are hard to reassemble, given the often secretive nature of such bases, the Pentagon has probably built up with the 50 lily pads and other small bases since around 2000, while exploring the construction of dozens of more. Wow.
As Mark Gillum, author of American Town, Building the Outpost of Empire, explains, avoidance of local populations, publicity, and potential opposition is the new aim. To project its power, he says, the United States wants secluded and self-contained outposts strategically located around the world. According to some of the strategy's strongest proponents at the American Enterprise Institute, the ARI, that's the neocon Bush boy, wait, where are you going?
Well, it's a long article, and we just have 3 minutes here.
Okay, awesome. The goal should be to create the worldwide network of frontier forts. The global cavalry of the 21st century.
Yeah, let's zoom down to the end here. Cause this
transforming the base empire and hitting the base reset button. This is a long
term. Oh, this is very, very long.
The new American way of war. And I would suggest you go to those dangerous lily pads. This is Tom. Go to Tom Englehart. All right? And it's and his website is antiwar.com.
And this was by David Vine and Tom Englehart. It's a very good article, but the
excellent
little,
article.
We can't read the whole thing.
Yeah.
We don't have enough time.
But excellent article for that. And this one, this is the one I thought I'd end with tonight. I it's okay with you. Right here.
Sure, how antibiotics
destroy your immune system. And there was one other, I don't know if that's talking about
Well, there was
I had this one on antidepressants in 2002.
Antidepressants?
Yeah, antidepressants given to that 5% of the world population take, which in the United States takes 60% of all the antidepressants.
They have such horrible side effects. People should be
and,
so careful.
And those lead to, and it talks about the side effects, what it is. And that,
Well, you know, if you listen to the mainstream media, one would think that the normal state for the human being is to be joyously happy at every moment.
Yeah.
Well, it just ain't true, folks. There's lots of things that happen in your life that the reaction to it is to be sad or unhappy.
Yeah.
And to learn how to cope with that. You can't take a pill for everything.
Huh.
Sadness is a normal state for the human being to be in sometimes. If you lose your parent or you lose a child or you lose a job or you lose your house, those are not joyous things.
No.
And a pill isn't going to change that really fundamentally.
Right. And anyway, we're just about out of time.
Yep.
So I want to thank everybody for joining us, and please join us tomorrow night when we have our friend Murray Dorman, Public Affairs Coordinator with the AFSCME Union. And tomorrow we're going to be specifically all union news, starting a new feature for our weekly programs, and we'll be dealing with the international, national, and statewide. So hope you enjoyed the show tonight and wish you the best. And please join us tomorrow night. And good night, everybody.
Good night, folks. Have a great day.